That was just to let you know to turn it on. Yeah. Thank you, and welcome everybody to the interim committee meeting of the Senate Committee on Transportation and Business. We've got a couple of items on transportation today. We're going to start off with the organizational meeting. It's a routine that we have to adopt our rules for operation during the interim. So we're going to start with that. Can I have a motion to adopt the rules? These are just the standard vanilla rules that we always have. We have a motion on the table. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. The rules are adopted. We got a couple of announcements. Just one, we're in the process of preparing for the February session. It's a short session, but I would tell folks that if you have ideas that you think are short and easy to deal with in February, I would suggest that you either get in contact with me or Patrick, either telephone call, or actually preferably if you're going to send an idea in for a rule, we'd rather have it in writing. You can email the committee, I think, can't we? Just collect it on the website and it'll get it to us. The deadline for that, Patrick, is?
The deadline for submission of bill drafting requests is after the legislative days in November, so it's officially November 24th is the last day for a committee to submit requests to Ledge Council.
I have to get it in. We're very limited on the number we have, but we're always welcoming the things, and if we can't get to them in February, we can always take a look at them for 17.
Right.
And other than that, Patrick, you had an announcement on this.
Yes. So, Mr. Chair, we have put before you just a little snippet of the 2015 summary legislation document. It's about 200 pages long, but we just put a couple sample pages on here, including a little piece of paper that has an explanation of where you can find this on the OregonLegislature.gov website if you're curious. It's compiled by committee staff at the end of session that kind of summarizes bills of import and or interest that arose during the session.
All right. Anything else from the members before we get into the informational? All right. So we'll move into our informational meetings. And, Patrick, you want to introduce it?
Oh, sure, Mr. Chair. I think the first one up, we'll do a major transportation construction projects update. Mr. Mather's here to discuss that with the committee, and I believe he has a slide presentation.
As always, welcome, Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Byers, member of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, here to give you my standard update of what ODOT's been up to this summer. If you've been probably on your summer vacations, we've been busy at work. Going to give you a run through of just a few projects, kind of a sampling of some of the major projects from around the state. I will tell you just one of the takeaways, our program continues to move along very nicely. The majority of the projects I'm going to talk about here, I'll report as is being ahead of schedule and under budget. There'll be a couple exceptions I'll point out going through, but from a program level, we're had a very successful summer. I'm going to start with a project on 140 outside of Klamath Falls. Actually, on my cover photo here is actually of that project. It's located on Bly Mountain, just outside of Klamath Falls towards Lakeview. This particular piece of highway is an older generation of highway that is narrow and windy and actually restricts truckloads in length between Klamath Falls and Lakeview. And this project will eliminate that restriction and allow the freight traffic to move more freely between Klamath Falls and Lakeview. As you can see, the windy, twisty portion of this highway and then the new straight highway that we're moving down through the center there. K&E Contractors out of Salem, K&E Excavation out of Salem is the contractors on the project. It's a $31 million project. About half of that is funded with JTA. The other half is federal funds. From the summit towards the east has been open to traffic, and next season they'll complete from the summit to the west, and this will be completed about a year from now, and like I said, lifting that truck restrictions. So here's a piece of the highway on the east side there that's been open. So a nice project for that portion of the state. Next, I want to talk about the Biggs Interchange. This is where 97 and 94 meet, just east of the Dalles.
A little further east.
Yeah, a nice project that I've reported on before. Again, this is a jobs and transportation project, $22 million project. Kerr Contractors is the contractor on this. Again, this has been done on time and under budget. Part of what we're talking about with the local area commission is taking the savings on the project, and you'll see just up here in the picture on the right where the highway climbs up the hill, using those extra funds to extend that climbing lane up the hill to help freight truck traffic in that area. But it's been a very nice project for completion. We had a nice ribbon cutting ceremony earlier this summer at the project. I will point out one thing. If you look in the background of this picture, a piece of trivia for you today, there's a traffic signal. That is the first traffic signal in Sherman County.
I love it.
Your piece of trivia for today.
I'm sure they love it.
So a nice looking project. You can see the detail that we have on the screening of the interchange. It's a very nice looking project. Next project's in Troutdale, I-84 at 257. This is at the interchange in Troutdale, just west of the Sandy River. Widening the structure underneath as you pull off and are headed eastbound today. If you want to head to the port property there on Marine Drive towards the north, you actually have to go off the picture to the east, cross under the freeway, then back to the intersection you see in the picture there before you move forward. This project actually widens that structure and allow that left turn to be made right at that intersection. So now when you pull off the interchange, you can make a left and head directly to the port property and the developments backed by FedEx, and it's a major economic hub for the region that this project's going to help facilitate. Well, there's a picture of that wider undercrossing that allow that.
Well, that handle, there's a lot of industrial expansion capability there at the old site there. Is that adequate to handle all that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we've been working with the port. There's improvements at the interchange as well as on the rest of the network leading back into that industrial site, and believe that these improvements funded through JTA will facilitate the growth in that area.
So just to the east of that little bridge there's one more old bridge. Are they going to fix that, or will the project be done? We're kind of tired of driving through all this.
So you're talking about the bridge just off the bottom east of this picture?
Uh-huh.
Is the one you're talking about?
Yeah.
So we're actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, we're actually talking about that as we're finishing up this project, seeing how much money is actually left. Again, this is another project that's coming in under budget, and we're seeing if we have enough funds to address that bridge. We're having an active conversation on that right now.
Senator, that's our way to slow you down.
Yeah. Thanks. Which one I go in here? Next project, Sunrise Corridor. It's one I've talked about a number of times in the committee. A major project, another economic hub of the region, the Clackamas area. The blue line there is the extension, or the Sunrise Corridor, extending the Milwaukee Expressway on out to 122nd, bypassing a major congestion area for the industrial uses in that area. This project's moving along nicely. We have opened up. If I can point to with my cursor here, this connection between 82nd Avenue, and this connects over to 82nd Drive. This connection just opened about a month ago, and I'll show you a picture of it here in a second. But the existing structure you see across the 205 here, the Milwaukee Expressway, that's going to be the new connection over onto the Sunrise Corridor. So right in that transition area between making that traffic transition. And you can see a picture of it here. See the bike ped facilities that we have in the center there. This is that new connection I was just talking about that will connect 82nd Avenue with 82nd Drive. And then this structure here goes off in a new alignment over the railroad tracks and onto 122nd. Project should be ready to open sometime early next construction season.
Senator.
And it was all clogged up this morning when we were trying to come down through there. Had to take a lot of detours and so on because I-205 was just stopped. I don't know, there was some kind of a wreck or something.
I thought that was just normal traffic on 205.
No, I don't think so. I just about didn't get here on time by 11 o'clock because of all that traffic, but...
Chair Byers, Senator Monroe, that's congestion that we're experiencing more. You're going to hear a couple more presentations later on the agenda around safety and our work to eliminate those crashes, and then also just on congestion in general.
So guess we better go to work on that transportation package.
Senator Thompson?
So that the Sunnyside connection, will that be done by next year, or what's the timetable on finishing that?
Senator Beyer, Senator Thompson, or Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, this portion of the Sunrise project will be opened sometime June, July timeframe is what we're thinking of next year. So we're making substantial progress on it, but we still have a portion of next construction season to finish it up. You'll see here's a photograph of just east of what the picture I showed you, the R-205. So we've got the major grading work is done, but still have some of the paving, and some of that we'll have to wait till weather comes next spring to finish up.
Okay, great.
Here's a picture of that new connection between 82nd Drive and 82nd Avenue that is open today. Newburgh-Dundee Bypass is another one I've talked about a number of times. Again, this is another portion of a very much larger project there in the upper photograph, showing the overall plan to alleviate this congested area between really the Dayton interchange on 99 clear through Dundee and Newburgh that is a major congestion area, particularly on weekends. The section that is funded through JTA and some federal funds is the lower portion on the map here. The sections, I'll point you with my cursor here, is under construction now, and we've actually divided it in half about in the center here. Hamilton Construction is doing called the left half, and the right half is being done by Wildest Construction. I'll show a couple photographs of that in a minute. The piece that's still left to be going to contract, and we'll start construction next summer, is the Springbrook Avenue connection back to 99, which will start next season. And this project is scheduled to be done 2 years from now, in the fall of 17. Project's moving along well. We have, here's a couple photographs of some of the work happening that you really can't see from the highway, but some nice work that's happening. The major viaduct, as we kind of thread the needle between the town and the paper mill in the area, this is work that Wildish Construction is doing on the project. We had a landslide in the area that is causing us a little trouble. It's not on the critical path of the project, so schedule-wise, we'll remain on schedule, but may eat into some of the savings that we have on this project. So we'll see how some of our instruments tell us how it's performing through the winter. Woodbend Interchange, another one I've talked about, and this is actually probably the last time you hear me talk about it because we've opened it up to traffic. Again, a very nice project in that area, a long-awaited for improvement to that interchange in that area. Here's a final picture of just the configuration, what it looks like. You see we still have a little bit of work yet to do in the landscaping, but the project has turned out very nicely. It's a project that's a year ahead of schedule. Again, K&E Excavating out of Salem is the contractor on this project, has done a very nice job for us. Under budget, ahead of schedule. The savings on this project, we have two other JTA projects, one in Tillamook and the Kubler Interchange in Salem that need a few million dollars to complete those projects. So we'll be moving savings of JTA savings from this project to either of those two projects to keep those moving forward. But it's a much more than an interchange project. You can see in this photograph it improved 219, 214 through the area and was a very nice improvement for the area. Had a nice ribbon cutting, several dignitaries there celebrating the success of the project. Pioneer Mountain Eddyville, another one I've talked about, and actually had the pleasure of hosting Senator Beyer on a tour of this about a month ago. Project continues to move along nicely. Again, this is a project that we've had our challenges with that I've talked about in the past. It's cutting off a 10-mile route to about a 6-mile route. Again, I'll remind the committee the sections here are completed on this end, and this section are done. The problem area you can see in the picture are these large cuts and fills that I'll show you a couple pictures of that have been a challenge for us. Next summer, while I got this picture up, next summer we'll be completing the paving on this route and then making this connection here at the West End curves will be the final piece of the puzzle to complete the project next summer. This summer we've completed the large fills in the area. You'll see what we call Eddy A here is actually completed. This fill in the foreground is just about complete. The largest fill in the project, what we call Crystal Creek, is nearing completion in this picture, and I think it might be complete as of today, but very, very close to being completed. There's another shot of it. There's over 1 million yards just in this one fill. It's a pretty spectacular project that really the pictures don't do it justice. The final large fill in the project is Cougar Creek, you'll see here, which is at final grade. And then we have a couple of cuts that we still need to do some final cleanup work on, but that'll be completed this season. Like I said, next year, the final portion of the project will put final paving on this and complete those west end curves. And if things go well, knocking on wood, we'll be having a ribbon cutting about this time next year.
Those pictures don't do justice to the engineering needed on that project. Well, it's just an amazing project. And those cuts are huge.
Yeah.
The culverts, those who haven't been out there, the culverts, the drainage culverts, are 7 feet high and double layer.
Yeah. Spectacular project. I'd offer anybody a tour. I know we've had Patrick out there and Senator Beyer out there, but anybody wants a tour of the project, it's a kind of a once-in-a-career project for a highway engineer anyway. Last project I just want to touch on is Highway 42. This is Highway 42 connects Roseburg and the Port of Coos Bay, a major freight corridor for Southern Oregon. Relatively small project compared to what the ones I've just talked about. It's a $10 million project, but similar in that it's the kind of the last piece of upgrade to a highway kind of from a previous generation, that they've kind of saved the hardest piece of that for kind of last. And whether it's Pioneer Mountain or the Bly Mountain project or this project, kind of finally getting to the final portion of the upgrade to that highway. And it comes with its challenges, too. There's a reason why these were saved till last, because they're very challenging pieces. And this one is having its own challenges that we're working through. It's going to cost us a year in schedule as we work through some of the issues that we're finding with a particular landslide's not behaving the way we thought it was going to behave. It'll cost us a little bit in the budget. The overall project cost on this about $10 million. But we'll be within the range of savings and other projects and so forth. We'll be able to cover it. But it's just a challenging as working in the coast range that we have with projects.
Senator Murrow?
Will that project, when it's completed, be a more efficient way to get from North Bend area to I-5 than the current, which most people go up to Reedsport and across the Umpqua Highway?
Chair Beyer, Senator Monroe, it really depends on which way you know you're going on I-5 and what your load is and so forth. Both those routes are used heavily by freight haulers, trucking. Depends on which particular mill or which particular area you're going to, but both of those are key routes to the Port of Coos Bay, and their connections north on I-5 or south on I-5 to the Roseburg area, both are used heavily by freight.
Okay.
Just one last shot of that project. But again, this last project, again, the smallest one that I've talked about, it's going to cost us a year on schedule. But on balance, the many major projects, hundreds of millions of dollars, we continue to be ahead of schedule and under budget on our program. Good. That's it.
Questions of Paul?
I've got one quick one.
Senator?
This isn't for any of the projects that you're doing. This last summer, I took a trip between Sweet Home and the pass, San Diego Pass. The highway up and through there is just in awful shape. Do you guys have any plans for repaving or fixing up there that you know of? Or most of the time,
sure.
It's not just one place, but I mean, there's a lot of sunken grades up in there, and it's really pretty bad shape.
Yeah, Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, you know, our connections to San Diego Pass, our priorities are Highway 22, Highway 126. And as we prioritize our resources, whether it's maintenance money or capital money, goes to those two routes ahead of Highway 20. It's not actually we ignore Highway 20. We're going to have a project going on up there currently to address a bridge problem and a landslide happening underneath the bridge, actually moving the bridge. It's called Sheep Creek Bridge. We have a contractor up there right now working on that. We're going to have another phase of that contract. It's going to be next summer. It's actually going to cause us to close the highway for a significant period of time to actually work on the landslide and the bridge issues up there. So it's a road we work on, but from a priority standpoint, making that east-west connection from the Mid-Valley over to Bend area, it's kind of the third on our list of priorities.
Well, let me follow up with that, because we spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the Eddyville part of Highway 20.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, to get that to Corvallis. You know, we spent a lot of money. It only makes some sense that that corridor then should be, I mean, Highway 20 is the direct route to the pass. So I think I would like it if you guys would rethink. I don't get me wrong. I live on Highway 22, so
right.
I want that to be, all three of them seem to be major corridors.
Chair Byer, Senator Girard, I guess with our limited resources, we listen to the users in that area, and they continually tell us that the priorities are Highway 22 and 126.
Depends where they're from.
Yeah, but from a broad sense.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you bring up a good point, though. I mean, that's one of the realities of the system we're into. When you have limited resources, I believe the first priority is to keep the major freight routes open. Okay. And keep those running. And by virtue of doing that, those other routes like that are just not going to get attended to. And that's just a reality.
So just to illustrate that point, I think just the Highway 20 project that you talked about earlier in my career, you may see portions of Highway 34 that goes to Walport out of Corvallis and then Highway 20 that goes to Newport. We had to make a strategic decision which one of those routes that are we going to make into a freight route. And we started making some improvements on Highway 34 and some improvements on Highway 20, but quickly realized that we need to prioritize one of those routes over the other, and Highway 20 has been prioritized over 34. And so today, Highway 20 is considerably much improved compared to Highway 34.
Paul, you just the department just released a status of the bridges report. Do you want to just touch on that very quickly?
Thank you, Chair Byer. Yes, we have an annual release of our bridge condition report that usually we just send out and don't make a lot of notoriety about. But we've had so much conversations about the condition of our bridges with the reports that we released prior to last session, the funding conversations we had. We spent quite a bit of time talking to our commission and releasing a lot of information about the condition of our bridges, both from a structural standpoint as well as a seismic standpoint, and the importance of both those. We continue to slowly head towards a cliff with our bridges, that as you look ahead 50 years, we have a bill coming due from the bridges that we built during the interstate era as they end their useful life and have to be replaced. We don't have the sustainable funding to meet those needs. And on top of the needs that we've continued to learn about from a seismic standpoint and the importance of our bridges, particularly in Western Oregon, from a seismic standpoint.
We don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
The big one, they're gone. Okay, any other questions? Senator Rundra?
Used to be that Congress passed a highway appropriation measure every 6 years, and they haven't been doing that lately. Is there any hope that our friends in Congress will come forth with the federal money? Absolutely essential. It's also essential that this committee and the full legislature pass matching state money so that you have both. You need both. You need the money from the feds, which used to be paid anywhere from 80% to 90% of your projects, and then you need, of course, the match right. from the legislature. So both are critical. I assume you're working closely with our friends in Congress, our congressional delegation, and so on, to try and get the federal package finally through in a bipartisan way.
Right.
And we understand that we didn't do our job last session either, and we need to keep working on that. I don't know if that was a question or a speech.
Yeah. That sounded like there was a question in there about what are you doing with the federal government, if anything.
Well, Chair Byer, Senator Monroe, yes, we continue to work with our delegation. At least what I'm seeing is they continue their past practice of just the continuing resolutions to move things forward at the current funding level on a fairly short-term basis.
The kicking the ball down the street.
Correct. I don't hear conversations or proposal from a long-term standpoint to solve the underlying problem of there's not enough funds coming into the federal trust fund relative to the amount that's being spent out of the federal highway trust fund. That gap needs to be closed in some long-term, meaningful way.
Yes.
Yep. We used to call it the user pay system, or proportional.
Yeah,
now it's just we've taken the pay piece off.
And it used to always be bipartisan.
All righty. Any other questions for Paul? Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciate that. We've got some other stuff, but we're going to skip down here and bring up the impact on traffic congestions. I understand we have some time constraints with some of the panelists.
Do you want me to call them up, Mr. Chair? So we have Ryan Winsheimer, who's the Region 1 Administrator for ODOT, Janet Jarvis with the Oregon Trucking Association, Jeremy Rogers with the Oregon Business Council, and DJ Vogt for the Oregon Business Association are going to be our panel, Mr. Chair.
Ryan made the mistake of telling me when we were out at Eddy Mountain that there's about the impact in Portland and across the states. I said, the committee needs to hear about that. You're up first. You're going to bring the good news. What the bad news?
Thank you, Chair Beyer. And yes, that's right. We did have an opportunity to talk about it, and I'm glad to be here today to tell you a little bit more. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Winsheimer. I'm the ODOT Region 1 manager. I'm here this afternoon to talk about the impacts of congestion on the highway system. From about 2009 to 2012, travel on Oregon's highway system actually declined. During that period, there were still traffic jams at rush hour, but the hours of congestion affecting our businesses and our workforce was not increasing. Today, Oregon's roads and highways are more congested for a number of positive reasons. The economy is improving, which means more trucks moving goods to market. More jobs means more people driving to work, and lower gas prices are making driving more affordable for more people. Through July of 2015, motor vehicle fuel consumption has been up about 4.1%, heavy truck activity is up about 3.9%, and total statewide vehicle miles traveled is up right around 5.8% over the year before. And the national average, that's only increasing about 3%. So it is more acute here in the state of Oregon. In addition to that, over the last year, about 75,000 drivers have turned in their out-of-state driver's licenses for Oregon ones. And that's about a 29% increase from 2009, an indication, of course, that more folks are moving here in greater numbers. All of these factors result in more congestion on Oregon's roads, which is being felt around the state, but most acutely in the Portland metro area. And I'm pleased to see the other panelists here today, who I'm sure are going to be able to tell you more directly how that increase in congestion is affecting their members, and as a result, the Oregon economy in general. ODOT's taking a number of steps to address congestion. First, thanks in large part to the Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009, we're widening roads and improving interchanges, a number of which you just got to see a presentation from Deputy Administrator Mather. For example, Highway 26 widening out to 185th was completed last year, and next year, also with JTA funding, we're going to begin construction of the next phase out to Cornelius Pass Road to better serve the Silicon Forest. On the eastern side of my region, Region 1, we're going to be cutting the ribbon on Sunrise Project. The legislature's $100 million investment in that area is projected to reduce congestion by over 1 million hours a year. 1 million hours of delay less per year that drivers will encounter in that corridor, improving the efficiency of the distribution centers there, the industrial area, as well as improving trips for residents and commuters on I-205, Highway 212, 224, and that entire corridor. And of course, back in 2009, the JTA provided similar investments across the state, the benefits of which we're now beginning to realize. Second, ODOT is making strategic targeted investments in safety and efficiency of our highways. For example, two recently completed projects that were delivered at around $10 million each were able to relieve two of the worst 250 freight bottlenecks in the entire country, as identified by the American Transportation Research Institute. Those were at I-5 North and South between I-205 and Wilsonville. Those two auxiliary lanes there are the projects I'm talking about, and if you've driven through there recently, it's substantially better than what it used to be. We've also undertaken a study ODOT Planning did that looked at corridor bottlenecks around the region and has identified a number of additional improvements that could have similar results. And then we're designing those now with sort of the hope that we'll be able to leverage those projects as we go and do our pavement projects. And that saves money to mobilize once and deliver those projects in concert with those investments. Third, we're investing in technology to improve safety and reduce the number of crashes that are slowing people down. I'm sure many of you have now had the opportunity to drive Highway 217 or I-5 at 405. And seeing some of the new ODOT real-time systems. As a result of those Q warning and other real-time elements, we've seen a 16% reduction in crashes and a 19% increase in travel time reliability. This is significant to our discussion today on congestion because reducing the number of crashes has big congestion benefits. As a rule of thumb, for every 1 minute of blocking traffic, it takes about 5 minutes to clear, as Senator Monroe had the experience of yes, dealing with this afternoon in I-205, unfortunately. Lastly, it's important to note that transit and other modes also play an important role in addressing congestion. ODOT Region 1 played an important role in the development of the recently opened Orange Line. We're working with TriMet to explore bus rapid transit on PAL Division and working hard to realize the vision as developed in the Mount Hood Multimodal Plan that provides additional access to businesses and recreation destinations on the mountain without the cost and environmental impacts of widening 26 in the National Forest. Even with these efforts undertaken by the department, the cost of congestion study is forecasting a tripling of time spent in congestion by 2040. ODOT spending its time and limited resources on developing some larger scale projects to relieve congestions in places like the Rose Quarter. But the upcoming STIP, we've made the difficult decision to invest 9 out of every 10 of our transportation dollars in maintaining our transportation assets. Given the size and scope of our ongoing maintenance needs, roads, bridges, and preventative measures like seismic retrofitting our bridges, it's unlikely that we're going to have the funding necessary to construct significant new capacity-enhancing projects without the addition of increased funding at the federal level, the state level, or both, again, as Senator Minow mentioned. Thank you for the opportunity to share what steps ODOT's taking to provide congestion relief, and I look forward to additional discussion following the other panelists.
You're putting a much more positive spin on it than when we were talking. I mean, politic, I guess. I want to reach back. You had made a comment to me about the percentage of increase in VMT, vehicles mile traveled, since the first of the year, first 6 months. What was that number?
In the first 6 months, it was about 6.1% increase in vehicle miles traveled here in the state of Oregon, which, again, is roughly double the national average of the rate of increase.
Can I ask a question? The question I would have is, how much does that have to do with the Port of Portland and all the problems that they're having up there? I have a lot of farmers now that can't stop at that port. They have to go up to Seattle, and it just seems like that's increased truck traffic as well.
Well, Chair Beyer and Senator Rod, I think that the ports issues, and I think some of the other panel members may have some more specifics around that, is likely increasing truck traffic. But given, again, the scale that you're seeing here, it's much more than that. It is the growing economy. It is lower gas prices. It's more than just that, certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Trucking Associations. I'm president of that. And I thought in today's conversation I wanted to begin by talking to you a little bit about the value of the trucking industry to Oregon. I think it's easy for us to overlook this, and it's the kind of comment I get from my friends when they see all the trucks on the road. And by the way, Senator Girard, the estimates are that there are about 800 to 1,200 additional trucks a week as a result of the port closure. But it's important to remember that everything that Oregonians consume at some point has been put on a truck. In the U.S., in the year 2014, trucks hauled 68.8% of all freight, some 9.96 billion tons. Oregon's highly dependent on traded sector industries, those industries that provide goods and services outside of Oregon and bring money back to the Oregon economy. And they are particularly dependent on an efficient transportation network. In 2012, the Oregon Transportation Network carried over $300 billion worth of goods. That was more than the value of the state's gross domestic product at $205 billion. And I think that's kind of an interesting statistic. Out of that, 72% of that was transported by truck, which is higher than the national average, and the value of that was $215 billion. In 2014, trucking collected 80.3 cents of every dollar spent on freight transportation, some $704 billion. Nationally, there are over 1.1 million motor carriers, including four hire and private fleets. In Oregon, there are currently over 7,500 motor carriers registered with the Motor Carrier Division of ODOT. In 2014, there were over 7.1 million people employed in trucking-related jobs. 3.4 of them were truck drivers. With that number, you need to understand that as of today, nationally, we're about 40,000 drivers short of meeting the industry's needs, and the expectation is that this will grow to over 200,000 in the next 5 to 7 years. So that speaks to the challenges that we're having in the trucking industry today. Competitive marketplaces require businesses to maintain consistently high levels of productivity in order to grow and succeed. This factor requires that the cost to move materials to production and the cost to move finished products to the marketplace must remain competitive. Unfortunately, congestion increases the cost of business operation and reduces productivity. Delay costs linked to congestion can reduce Oregon's ability to remain competitive. In Oregon, according to a study on the cost of congestion that was done in the last couple of years, there are 346,400 jobs that are transportation related, about 20% of the jobs in the state. That means that the growing issue of congestion on Oregon's roadways challenges our ability to remain competitive. We recognize that the state provides key international air and maritime gateways, but these modes are dependent as well on highway access to trucks for freight shipments and business deliveries, what is commonly referred to as the last mile connection to intermodal facilities, business operations, and end users. I often refer to the fact that trucking serves as the lifeblood of Oregon's economy, if you think about it. The result is that congestion, particularly in the metropolitan areas, can affect operational decisions and costs of both the resource-based industries in our state, as well as the trucking firms that deliver their goods. The cost of congestion study I referenced earlier noted that in 2010, 5% of all travel time in the Portland metro region took place in congested conditions, i.e. stop and go or slow traffic. This is expected to triple to 15% by 2040, costing the average Portland metro household 69 hours of congestion annually, as well as significantly driving up the cost of delivering the goods that Oregonians want. In addition to that, I need to mention that business operations, trucking operations today, are nearing the limits in what they can do to overcome these transportation congestion issues. Staggered shifts, evening and overnight operations, increasing deliveries during off-peak hours are some of the examples of how companies are addressing this issue. Where businesses cannot shift to off-peak hours, there are lost turns on truck deliveries due to congestion, meaning that trucks take on fewer delivery routes in a day, increasing their costs and reducing their efficiencies. In addition to that, there are hours of service regulations federally, along with mandated rest breaks at certain periods of time. And when you factor in the fact that there's very few places for trucks to park to take those breaks, it exacerbates the inefficiencies lost due to congestion. You couple that with the growing driver shortage issues, you start to understand the problems our industry is having today. The same study I referenced earlier points to the fact that investments in Oregon's transportation system would have a significant impact on our economy. While as many as 8,300 jobs could result from these investments, it's been calculated that there's an additional $2.40 return for every dollar spent in the state's transportation system. Additionally, reducing congestion, particularly in our metropolitan regions, would have a significant reduction in the carbon output of stalled and idling vehicles, yep, and bring a meaningful strategy to the reduction of greenhouse gases. With the backdrop of U.S. consumer spending bigger than the gross domestic product of any other economy in the world, it's important to note that the projections for the total tonnage of primary freight shipments is expected to increase from 14.96 billion tons in 2015 to 19.24 billion tons in 2026, an increase of over 28% in the next 11 years. The revenue from shipping the freight will increase from $872 billion to over $1.5 trillion by 2026. With that in mind, the Oregon Trucking Associations would ask for the legislature to take this into consideration to make the investment in its roadways to accommodate this growth allowing for Oregon-based companies to participate in the expansion of the trucking industry. And just as a side note, I would mention to you that, Senator Monroe, that I am headed back to D.C. to have the same conversation next week, and you're more than welcome to join me.
I wish you well.
Okay, thanks, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is DJ Vogt. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Oregon Business Association. And I'm here today to talk about some of the impacts congestion has on Oregon businesses. And then I'll share a specific example from one of our prominent members, Columbia Sportswear. The following factors have been identified as being primary challenges facing business in Oregon today with respect to congestion: increased delays and reduced reliability, operations overtime costs, inventory costs, extended operational hours, dispersion of warehousing and operations locations, and the diversion of shipments to ports and airports outside our region. While these factors influence Oregon's ability to serve domestic markets, there's another factor that bears on Oregon's ability to compete domestically. This is the fact that as it takes longer to move into and out of the state or our metropolitan areas, the number of markets that can be served shrinks. Whether this is the labor market or the markets for finished goods, the longer it takes to get to these markets, the less competitive Oregon-produced products become. So, congestion in Oregon's urban centers can make goods purchased or produced, in other parts of the state less competitive just because they have to move through places like Portland on our major highways like I-5, I-205, and I-84. When congestion becomes sufficient to increase these business costs, all of the natural advantages that the Oregon's coastal ports, inland highways, rails, and waterways, and Portland's sea and airports, these advantages become much less advantageous and even become some liabilities when congestion becomes such a major cost for doing business here. And just as important as attracting new businesses, the things that congestion affects also makes the expansion of existing businesses and retaining them a lot more challenging. Thinking back to estimates of future congestion that were presented and will be presented, I believe, in Jeremy's talk, it's possible to understand why the increased congestion is not only costly to business, but it's easier to understand why businesses are concerned about their ability to compete and expand if congestion is only going to get worse. Now, I'll talk a little bit about one of our prominent members, and all of you are probably familiar with Columbia Sportswear, a major international brand and Oregon-based and homegrown company. Columbia operates its distribution from the Rivergate Industrial District in North Portland. It also has a major distribution center in Kentucky and a regional distribution center in Orlando, Florida. Columbia also operates a nationwide network of more than 85 retail stores and fulfills e-commerce from its Portland and Kentucky distribution centers. Columbia relies on both air freight and containerized services for the receipt of inbound merchandise. Containerized merchandise from Asia arrives primarily at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. There it is transloaded to trucks and dispatched to either the Kentucky or the Port of Portland's Industrial District warehouses. These ports are used primarily because they provide the best West Coast location to serve their two central U.S. distribution warehouses. The Rivergate Center in North Portland receives about 1,600 containers per year from these ports. The Rivergate facility is about 800,000 square feet with 16 revolving doors and 31 shipping doors. And Columbia requires customers to provide outbound shipping from its location in Rivergate to their own warehouses. Customers either provide drop trailers or arrange driver pickups, which are pre-packed and loaded by Columbia Sportswear warehouse staff. Customer operations are typically handled by third-party logistics firms and for-hire drivers. Typically, there are about 100 trailer loads per day leaving the warehouse, and a mix of express package, less-than-truckload, and truckload shipments. Columbia also operates a small private fleet of trucks that deliver to their three local outlet stores. Now, for Columbia, This congestion is affecting their inventory control. And this will be the same for many other retail distributors. Although congestion does affect fuel consumption, it's not a major factor in assessing operation changes. The most significant effects of congestion on inventory management for Columbia is their holding time for stock. Late arrivals by customers' trucks backs up available doors in the distribution center. When doors are backed up, goods are not moving, and that's a cost. This is a problem that typically begins in the early afternoon, but is really noticed at the end of the month when most of their orders are outbound. For Columbia, congestion also affects their expansion potential, and is the case for others as well. Companies are confronting the effects of limited expansion potential and region-wide congestion. Expansion opportunities for Columbia are currently limited. Current operations have grown so sufficiently that it's evaluating the timing and locations of where they will expand. They're assessing the availability of contiguous available space for warehousing operations, including yard areas for drop trailers and surge loading, which is significant at the end of the month, like I just commented on, when between 35 and 50% of their outbound traffic occurs. So in conclusion, Columbia is a well-known major employer in Oregon. Just one example where its expansion potential and current hiring plans are being hindered by congestion. We urge this legislature to take up a transportation package that addresses a serious impediment for Oregon's economic prosperity. Thanks.
Questions? I guess we'll get to it.
Great. Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girod, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Jeremy Rogers. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Business Council, and I also manage the Oregon Business Plan. And I will try to not repeat what you've heard, but my colleagues here, I think, have done a wonderful job describing the importance of transportation to the economy, the negative impact of congestion to the economy. And I had some slides, some of which have been covered, but I will just kind of skim through those and hit the stuff that you may haven't seen. And Jana did a great job talking about the particular importance of transportation to Oregon's economy because of our trade dependence. Oregon is uniquely positioned on the Pacific Rim, which creates tremendous opportunities for our economy moving forward. But it also means that transportation is even more important, and that's all modes of transportation. But as Jana mentioned, trucks are critical, and they intersect with every mode. And the last mile issue that Jana spoke about is key. So regardless of kind of what mode you're talking about and the investments needed in those modes, equivalent investments in highways are critical in order to get goods to their final place where they're heading. And this graph here is from the Port of Portland, and it shows you these are businesses that have containers coming in or out up and down the I-5 corridor. It doesn't show you the number of containers, but just businesses. And the point I want to make is that, this isn't it isn't just Columbia Sportswear, and it's a lot of small businesses as well. And particularly, you saw in the last slide, even when we're talking about our export economy, 80-90% of those companies are small and mid-sized businesses. So the transportation network is critical to all these companies, and congestion in particular is becoming a bigger and bigger problem. And it's really a competitiveness issue for a variety of reasons that you heard earlier today. DJ talked a lot about the business issues. It's also from a quality of life standpoint. You know, two of the reasons why Oregon has been traditionally a attractive place for particularly for people and for companies is because it hasn't had the congestion problems that other places have, and you know, it's been an affordable place to do business. And what we're seeing with the rapid increase in congestion is that that advantage is going away. Our congestion problem, as Patrick mentioned in the last year, is getting worse than other places. And if we lose that, the competitive advantages we have, you know, the people say, well, I go to Portland because it's too crowded in San Francisco and it's too crowded in Seattle and it's a mess in those places. Well, Portland's becoming a mess like that too. And if that goes away, and we don't have, you know, the difference between those places, they have a lot of anchors that we don't have. We don't have the Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks and all the companies that are going to kind of force people to be there regardless. Oregon has really relied on the quality of life issue to attract talented workers. And so from a business and a consumer and family perspective, we're at risk. Jana mentioned the cost of congestion study that we all worked on together. And the purpose of this slide is to show you that if we do make investments, we can fix this problem. The congested future projection is that 69 hours per household will be spent in congestion per year in the Portland region, and 18 hours in other regions of the state by 2040 if we don't make investments. But if we do, we can reduce that to 37 hours in Portland and 6 hours in other areas of the state. And as others have mentioned, that has huge economic benefits. About $1 billion to the Oregon economy, that's about $800 per household, and about 8,300 jobs per year if we make those investments. So I want to come back to the competitiveness issue. This is a different study, the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. They have been tracking congestion and its costs in all the metro areas in the United States since 1982. And what I've done on this slide is show you 2 years, last year and 10 years before that, 2004. In 2004, the Portland area ranked 25th largest metropolitan area by population. Our daily per commuter congestion rank was 25th out of the 50 states, and our average cost of that delay per consumer was 23rd. In 2014, we were the 23rd largest metro area, but our congestion rank was 12th, and our cost of that congestion per commuter was 11th. And so we're heading in the wrong direction, and it's pretty serious compared to other places. So I really think it's important to see it as the as a competitiveness issue with other locations. I do want to just conclude by playing a video of Steve Zika from Hampton Affiliates talking about the importance of reducing congestion and improving the transportation system to his company, including mills that he has in Tillamook, Willamina, and a third location that I'm blanking on right now.
Our business revolves around timber supply, people, and then transportation. And so we use 13,000 rail cars a year, 47,000 trucks, 150,000 log trucks, 25,000 containers going out of the west. So transportation is a huge part of our business. Now we're facing severe congestion around the northwest in a lot of our transportation systems, but just the infrastructure is wearing down on bridges, roads, and so it's having a big effect in terms of our costs are going up. Customers this day and age, when you're in a global marketplace, everybody's just in time. We have appointments with certain customers, 15-minute windows when we can deliver product. So if you have congestion, you miss a window, there goes that sale. The next step is to see if we can bring alignment to the political process so our federal delegation, our state leaders, and our local politicians all understand the importance of these investments we have to make. They're long-term investments, but they have huge paybacks.
And thank you for the opportunity, and like my colleagues, I encourage the legislature to work with those of us up here and others to get a transportation package sometime in the near future. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
I got one quick one. This one's for Jana. I asked the question about the ports and the increase in trucks. I got 600 to 1,200 trucks.
I have been told there's about 800 to 1,200.
800 per what?
Week.
Per week.
That's where all those people came from. Other questions?
Rough estimates, Senator.
I think the projection, and Ryan, you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's a study, a national study, that said in the major markets, the ones you represented, Jeremy, that between now and 2030, the congestion expected to increase by 30%.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which study you're talking about, but yes, and here we're talking about congestion tripling by, as the study recommended, by 2040, and you're seeing things like now the city of Portland is just talking about its recent estimates of growing by about a third over the next 20 years. So those are the kinds of things we're going to need to figure out how to accommodate. And my testimony, you mentioned it was positive. I was talking about the positive things that we are trying to do to maximize what we can out of the existing system. I think we're doing a great job of that. But without the investments that we saw on, like the Jobs and Transportation Act, it's going to be difficult to see large capacity improvements coming anytime soon.
it's going to get tougher. I mean, I'm not sure that there's room to do a lot of things. You're doing a good job of what you're doing, but there's a limitation on how much of that. I think we have to start looking at some other ways of doing things.
Yeah. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, that's absolutely right. And as you've seen, we moved into an idea where we're working on technology, trying to better manage our system. We recently just got the big Tiger grant that's talking about how we can improve and add that real-time system on 26 out to the airport and do some of these things that, again, is maximizing that existing system, but trying to accommodate the type of growth that you heard these folks mention today. It would be difficult to do that, and we're gonna have to keep looking for solutions.
Great. Senator Monroe.
Any success in finding carriers that do container cargo work? We lost a couple of major carriers in the last couple of years, and I wondered if folks are having any success in wooing additional carriers, Pacific Rim carriers, and also if things are improving in terms of the labor market and the labor disputes. I've been very, very disturbed by the fact that sometimes these container facilities at the Port of Portland have basically shut down, not because of management and labor disputes, but because of labor disputes. You know, whose jurisdiction is it? And I just wondered if there's any movement and anything that we can do politically to improve that. Portland is ideally, the Portland metropolitan area is ideally located as a transportation hub for the whole Pacific Northwest because of the Columbia River Gorge, because of the multimodal facilities, because of the fact that we combine river barge traffic with rail traffic, with truck traffic, and so on, and that it is critical to the whole economy of the region. But if you have disputes, one union against another or whatever, that shuts that down or shuts down one aspect of that intermodal ability, it's very, very troubling and has a major impact, not just in the Portland metropolitan area, but all over the state, even where this guy lives.
Yeah, I don't think there was a question there.
I don't.
No, I was listening for one.
Another one of my little speeches. Sorry.
Anybody else? Great. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Now we're going to move to traffic safety. See some of the impact and some of the things that's happening out on the road. So, Paul and Amy and Captain Anderson. Did I do something wrong?
Well, I was going to recommend, given OLCC folks have some time constraints, so maybe we could do the OLCC presentation now and then come back to the safety one, if that's okay, Mr. Chair. The folks in the back of the room you just called up are okay.
All right, we'll switch gears then. We'll go to, you know, he's having a bad day. Start on the floor. His staff keeps shifting things around on me. Is there a page I didn't get again? Hi, Renee.
I'm waiting for Steve here. Right here.
So we'll do OLCC. Mr. Marsh, duck out on you?
Good. Who are available to carpool into the city?
Told he's going to be returning shortly. Do you want to stand at ease for just a moment? Or we could just.
Well, that would be up to Renee. She's probably been doing all the work anyway. Colleagues, just as a bit of an intro, you remember during session we talked about increasing the number of outlets across the state in different ways, and particularly in the Portland area. OLCC has been looking at this and has a proposal on that they're considering, I guess, or maybe you've acted on. And we've had a request that the committee at least hear about that and take a look at it. Mr. Marks, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chair, Steve Marks, Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Commission. With me is Renee Niedermeyer, our Governmental Relations. Thanks for this opportunity to report on a proposal that we put forward to expand the number of liquor outlets in the Tri-County metropolitan area. Just for a start, as you know, this conversation, I think, goes back almost to my first days at OLCC when we were looking at ways to innovate convenience and expansion and change in our liquor system. Worked on the hybrid proposal in that short session a year and a half ago. It's been on our minds about how we move forward. The legislature was very good to us and invested in the expansion of the warehouse and our capacity and put us in position to meet the distribution needs of our liquor system well into the future. We're now looking at how we actually, you know, expand that convenience and our system to meet Oregonians' future demand. I had the occasion this weekend to be at ALSO's trade show, so we had a frank and good conversation again about why we were moving forward and what this proposal looked like. I take full responsibility for moving this out very quickly after session occurred, because I felt like we got delayed as we got into the marijuana issue, which has taken up an inordinate amount of our time. And with that, though, I'd say that with the proposal you see in front of you, it relies on all our tried and true systems for appointment of agents, and we'll explain the differences to you along the way here. So with that, we have an open recruitment process, meaning that instead of the commission picking out locations where we think we might need expansion within the market, this is open, market-driven in the respect that those proposers will be selecting the areas in which they want to run a liquor store on behalf of the state. So we're calling for the appointment of up to 17 new liquor agents in the Tri-County area. And, of course, our objective there is to improve convenience, meet future demand, and also meet our needs to raise revenue for the state into the future. Liquor density is a reason, and I think you've heard in our budget process before when I reported to this committee, our average is one store per 16,000 residents. Used to be one per 12,000 residents in the Tri-County area. It's one per 25,000 residents. So you can see we have some room to bring the Tri-County area down towards the statewide average. I just want to pick, you know, what's the magic of 17 stores? And I don't think there's any particular magic there. We tried to pick a number that we thought was reasonable. So to give you some context around that, and we don't have to select 17 stores. It's up to 17 under the proposal put forward. Adding 17 stores in the Tri-County area will reduce the ratio from one store per 25,000 to one store per 20,000 in that area. The Tri-County area is projected to grow the fastest at 1.3% annual growth rate compared to the rest of the state of 1.1%. And Washington County is going to grow at 1.7%. And right now, Washington County has one of the highest ratios in the state of one store per 28,000 residents. So that gives you a context of what 17 stores would mean. Next slide shows you the areas, zip codes where there are no liquor stores in the area. So this is information for our potential proposers of where they might look to site liquor stores. and open recruitment. So this is a process, isn't a new process. You know, we're going to have multiple proposers. It's focused on the Tri-County area. If this process works, gets the kind of proposals we want, capitalized proposals, you know, interesting new work, and brings them actually forward, we intend to use this kind of process and go around the geography of Oregon to expand our system. And we'll pick, obviously, different ratios, different things to meet the market needs in those other areas. So we're looking forward to seeing how this works and, you know, match and giving us the ability to match the market in the future. We hope it does that. Minor differences from the existing process, I think, and not insignificant differences, but differences. The applicants may apply for multiple locations. Even though a single applicant could apply for multiple locations, each site will be considered individually under the criteria by the commission. Existing liquor sale agents are generally limited to two stores. Under this open process, we would allow them to propose for any of the 17 stores. And they have a great amount of experience here, and we expect to see proposals from them. We do need to, because of the store and some of those concepts, we want to be able to make sure that we can control minors in those instances, and we are proposing to alter our minor control plan or our minor rules or minor access rules to ensure that every new location would have a minor control plan. That rulemaking process takes 180 days, so that's part of the reason we needed to start soon. We needed that clock to get running, so we're under a process that's timely with that rule change. And applicants can propose locations under all of our business models, and these are all models that exist. And I think you'll be not surprised, but when you see the diversity of our models, it's a wide array of models. So, you know, we're looking for market focus, creativity, entrepreneurism, innovation. We want to see different mix of retail proposals for the commission to consider. And, you know, we're doing this all to benefit the customers and to work to stabilize our revenues into the future. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Renee to talk about the models that we do have.
Before you go forward, I'm just curious. One of the slides back there said the commission will select proposals based on quality and location.
Yes.
How are you going to define quality?
We have in the slides, Renee will go through the criteria, so we can at least give you an idea. But just so you know, the criteria that you see there are the very criteria which we selected every agent in the state.
Okay. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Affairs and Communication for the OLCC. What I wanted to do here is just talk about our existing stores and illustrate that to talk about these are the types of models that we'll be looking for proposals. They could fall in any one of these categories. We currently have 348 stores statewide. 150 of them are standalone liquor stores. They either have distilled liquor only or distilled liquor, beer, and wine and related items. So they're standalone stores. We have 91 locations that are located in another business with no separate entrance, and I'll give you some examples of what those look like. And we have 7 locations where we have a liquor outlet in an existing store with separate entrances that close off. So most of the businesses that are located in other businesses are in the rural areas, not as much as in the metropolitan area. Here's an example of the freestanding liquor store. This is our Cedar Mills liquor store, and as you, this is the one, I think when I first came to the OLCC, I thought that all of our liquor stores were pretty much freestanding because that's all that I had seen. So this is what most people are familiar with. Again, we have 150 of these. The Sun River store has a separate entrance. We have seven of these types of stores, but again, as I explained before, it's a very distinct area that's separated off from the rest of the goods that are sold. In Sisters, you have the same entrance, so they have sell a variety of items in the Sisters store, and liquor, distilled liquor as well. And we have 91 of those types of stores around the state. Again, this just gives you some idea of the variety of types of stores. We have deli, convenience, and liquor stores. We have lumber, hardware, and liquor. We have pharmacy and liquor, sporting goods and liquor. And so folks have been pretty creative.
I was just saying sporting goods and liquor, I understand, but hardware and lumber, I don't want to be on a ladder fixing the roof and drinking.
So. Mr. Chair, it's easier to get hammered at a hardware store.
That was pretty good.
I'll be here all week.
Scores.
Waiting for that.
That scores.
Okay.
Good point. Moving
right along.
This is a complicated, busy chart. Not the only really important thing here is all of those different types of stores that I just described go in one of two categories. They're either an exclusive store or a non-exclusive store. What an exclusive store means is they can sell distilled spirits and related items. Those related items could be Coca-Cola, glassware, ice, those types of things that are related to distilled spirits. A non-exclusive store can sell distilled spirits and beer and wine and related items, or they could sell distilled spirits and lumber, tackle, a whole host of things. Okay. This gets to your selection criteria requirement and how these applications will be evaluated. And as Director Marks explained, it'll be on the same criteria that we already use with our existing locations. The applications will be rated on their business proposal. They'll be rated on the level of financial investment, their financing plans and their capital investments. We will be looking at their retail experience or their general business experience. If they have knowledge of the alcohol industry, that's a plus. There are a couple slight differences. We will be looking at upper location. We'll be looking for convenience, but we'll also be looking at the impact on our existing agents. So we want to make sure that when we select locations, that we're very careful there, and we can talk more about that later. We're going to be looking at the estimated sales and revenue, and again, focusing on that customer service, and as Director Marks mentioned before, a minor control plan as well. Our open recruitment starts in the middle of October, and it'll go to January 15th. That's for this particular recruitment period. We will be having applicant informational meeting starting the 16th, but as you'll see in the next slide, we're also going to have a couple pre-applicant meetings just to try it out a little bit, and we're going to have some town hall informational meetings, so we'll talk about that. The applications will be reviewed as they come in. So we're not going to save them all up and bunch them up, but they will go to the commission all at one time. And so we could spread out the work as they come in. The commission will be making their selections if we have good applicants in our February commission meeting. And then once they have that, the selections are need to have, well, they'll have their location on them, and then we have to put our public notice out for the locations. If there is no public opposition, then the license will be granted. But if there is public opposition, then we will have an opportunity at the March Commission meeting to relook at that application again. All of this information is on our website. It's you can go to our very front page right now. There's an entire open recruitment. The process is there. The application forms will be up in a couple days, hopefully tomorrow. The application forms will be there. A sample contract will be there. All the information that you need if you're an individual that's applying for a location, if you're LLC that's applying for a location, or if you're a corporation that's applying for a location. There we go. And as I mentioned before, we are holding some town hall type meetings at our OLCC headquarters. We're doing that Thursday at 6:30 in the evening and Friday at 10. These are our first meetings, so we expect to have a few more as we get through this process. And we'll be going through the application process, the criteria for selection, answering any questions people might have, and making our initial contacts with folks. And then our retail services folks will be working with them as they fill out the applications.
So you could end up with, at the end of the process, anywhere from appointing one to 17. Appointing none to 17 stores.
Correct. Correct. It's all dependent upon the quality of the applications that we have and the decisions that our commission makes.
Senator Ryder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed a couple of things while I was looking at the material. And one of the things was, is it currently the case that an owner can only have two stores? Is that the case currently? Sure. And we're changing that? Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lye, we allow two stores today. We would be allowing them to propose for any number of the open recruitment stores, 17. So an agent could, an individual could propose for those stores under the open recruitment.
Or Safeway,
correct. A chain could, LLC, corporations, or otherwise. Remember the important point with respect to the idea that the chain would propose. We're going to judge each site individually, and that also means individually with respect to the location of our agents and the competition there. So a chain couldn't blanket come in, take 17 stores, and would all be approved for that chain. We'd consider each of the 17 sites individually.
So there'd be a separate proposal for each store?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And I also noticed that 97124 is one of the locations, which is where I live. Wow.
You live in a liquor store?
I live in 97124, and the liquor store is a block away. And I noticed, not from my house, but from that zip code, and I've seen no crowds there. It's never very, very busy, even on Saturday, which is pretty amazing. So I'm curious about, there's only one liquor store in Hillsboro and seems to be all we need.
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, I believe we simply identified all the zip code locations in the Tri-County area that don't have a liquor store. This doesn't say whether those zip codes would accommodate market demand.
Senator Johnson?
Yeah, just curious. So you have the agents that are out there now, and they're, by your numbers, they're getting a lot more traffic than beginning, so I'm sure they're not too excited about this, but I guess they have the opportunity. When they sign up to be an agent, do you tell them ahead of time that, here's our average, at some point in time we're going to increase stores? Does that matter to them? Is it in their contract? How is all that perceived by those folks?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson. You know, I haven't actually sat in when we signed the contract, but I've seen the contract that they signed several times, and I sign renewals readily. You know, renewals are common. We keep re-upping our agents regularly, and we rarely make changes unless there's some egregious problems, and even that has been rare within the system. What they know is that the contracts are pretty deferential to the OLCC side of the equation. Okay. Both with respect to compensation and the terms. It does give them abilities, but as I keep saying, I'm not sure I'd sign one of those, but they must know something about their profitability that I don't.
Sure. Senator Thompson, I'd also like to point out that in the last 10 years we have added 13 different locations. Our last one was in 2013, but we have added locations in the past.
Another question. So, I don't see a lot of these in Oregon, but if you go into, like, where my folks live in Wyoming, almost every liquor store is in a Safeway or some grocery store. It's separated out, like you guys talk about, and it has its own exit, but they're almost all in a supermarket. Do we have any of those facilities in Oregon? I haven't.
So I believe the answer is yes. I can't answer specifically to the separate door entrance, but I believe those are located within our models. And you'll find that a lot of states have that store within the store model, yeah. Whether they're a control state or not. A lot of states have provided for that in their statutory law.
A lot of the smaller stores, and I can think of two of them in my district, they're just small, rural. Well, one of them's not rural, Brownsville grocery stores, but they're just there.
Yeah.
It's just you go into the store and it's there.
Okay.
But I don't think we have any in large grocery stores.
Lamb's Thriftway. Mm-hmm. Senator Beyer, I believe we have them in Lamb's Thriftway. We have one in Lamb's.
A Thriftway?
One. Uh-huh.
Okay.
One.
One.
I guess the model that I always think about is if you go down to Nevada or California, which are much different, there's a liquor store on about every corner, and they're in every Safeway, Albertson, you know, they're just there. You know. More on this. Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I have a number of questions and concerns. My number one concern, and the reason that I've always supported the Oregon system, is because of availability to minors.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to do a better job of keeping this stuff out of the hands of minors than the non-controlled states. And so that's something that I'm concerned about. If you're going to expand and going to allow additional stores, make sure that you don't loosen up on access to minors in any way. So I'm concerned when you open new stores that don't have an exclusive entrance, that it might be easier for teenagers to sneak in there and snake a couple of bottles. The other thing I'm very concerned about is Oregon has a burgeoning craft distillery business. And our current liquor agents seem to do a pretty good job of allowing access to those craft products that are fairly small in volume, perhaps, but very important to those craft industries. There's a number of them in Hood River, for example. I think we need to respect those new business, those burgeoning businesses, and make sure that we don't do anything to damage them in terms of availability. If there are communities that don't have liquor stores, and that people in those communities would have to travel a significant distance to get to a liquor store, then that's where new stores ought to be sited. That makes sense to me. If there are communities that already have a liquor store very close or available or more than one. There's where I live, there's two within about 2 miles, and you know, it's pretty easy to get your bottle of booze if you want it. So availability is important. If a community doesn't have it available, then that's fine. I hope you will be very careful in citing new stores. I noticed that your proposal deals only with the Portland area. That seemed a little strange to me, because I would think that statewide, you know, maybe it's some of the more rural areas that might not have currently access to liquor stores. The other thing is the liquor stores that are near the state of Washington are doing very well, thank you, right now. And I've talked to the owners in those stores, and they're just really, really happy with what the good folks up in Washington did, because it's massively increased their business. That's fine. I have no problem with that. If our businesses, our entrepreneurs are taking advantage of the stupidity of our folks to the north, that's fine with me. I don't want to head that direction.
Good questions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, I just say I think those goals are the goals that the commission shares and wants to see in this proposal overall. When you look at the list that you delineated through, I think those are all really important considerations. And, you know, had a frank discussion with agents over last weekend, and, you know, we haven't forgotten how important that they're the engine of the system that they have, and that they have made the sales that have generated over $1.1 billion for the state of Oregon. The commission doesn't want to damage that structure either. And, you know, but we do have to accommodate growth. We do need to show we can innovate. I think we've shown some things through partnership, by being able to make the investment in the warehouse, by being able to increase compensation for the non-exclusive stores. We've taken some steps forward together. I got to admit, I moved out this proposal fairly quickly after session. But we've got to keep those connections working together, and I hope that we soon have an invigorated governance structure between OLCC, working with our independent agents to keep that communication more ubiquitous. And a lot of these conversations that we're having about what we look at the future, I think, in the business models we can have, tie back to really how do we allocate compensation and how we're supporting these businesses. And you heard me talk before when we were talking about innovation. I really think we need to look at contracts that match the different types of businesses we have out there to provide them positive opportunity for positive sales and growth and more rewards on their end as they move forward. That's all going to take some time.
Yeah.
And we did the best with the tools and law to give you a proposal that would begin the process. We'll see how it works in the Tri-County area. And as we said, we'll move it throughout the state if it matches our hopes and desires.
Follow up?
Sure.
Current system is actually working pretty well. Mm-hmm. It's providing reasonable living for some small business people and reasonable access to alcoholic beverages to the community. So my recommendation would be err on the side of caution. Make sure you have appropriate public hearings, opportunities for citizens to comment on a proposed new location, and err on the side of caution.
Appreciate that.
Thank you very much. All righty, we have one more panel discussion. Now we'll go back.
Absolutely.
You got another change for me?
No, I have all of the things to juggle, Mr. Chair.
We'll go back to transportation. Safety issues.
Appreciate you juggling those people around so you can take on.
Yeah.
Senator Beyer, member of the commission, and again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, going to give you a brief today on the increase we're seeing in traffic crashes and particular fatalities that we've seen. You saw the presentation earlier, an increase in VMT, and you're going to hear us talk about how that plays a part in some of the increases that we've seen over the last year in serious traffic crashes and fatalities. Just as an introduction, as we think about safety from a highway transportation standpoint, we think about the four E's, and we're going to be using that today in our presentation. So we think about education and educating the drivers and users of the system. We think about engineering. We think about enforcement, and we think about emergency response. So to kick us off in this, Amy Joyce from the department is going to talk a little bit about the background of some of the numbers that that we've seen over the last year, and then talk about what her division is doing from an educational standpoint. I'll talk about some of the engineering pieces and our emergency response, ODOT's role in emergency response, and then Captain Anderson will talk about the enforcement aspect of this. So it's a quick outline. That's what we're going to cover, and we'll start with Amy.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation today, representing our Transportation Safety Division. We appreciate you calling us forward to talk about this important topic, transportation safety. This is going to be a heavily data-driven presentation, and I want to make two quick points about the data. One is that a lot of this is preliminary data. When we have a fatal crash, it can be months and months and months before we have really final solid data on numbers, on causative factors, and that can have to do with whether it's accident reconstruction, toxicology reports, any number of things. So please appreciate that some of these numbers may change slightly over time, but we wanted to come forward with the best information we had at this point, but those numbers may change slightly. The second thing is, we're going to be talking a lot about data, numbers, percentages, pins on a map. And I want to be clear that we are talking about individuals who have died on our roadways. And that is not lost on the department. We take it very much to heart. And so while we'll talk about data, we never lose sight of the fact that these are people and people who have left behind loved ones in these fatal crashes. So with that, the data is pretty sobering, I will say. This is 2015 data, and the most recent, just pure numbers of deaths, again, preliminary, but are through September 23rd. In 2015, over 30% increase in the number of fatals on Oregon roads. The number of crashes where we have fatality, again, up over 30%. Pedestrian deaths up starkly, over 60% increase over this same time period, 2015 over 2014, and motorcycle deaths up by a count of six, that's 15% increase in this first nearly 9 months of the year. So what does this look like on a map? This is a map of Oregon, and each of these yellow points indicates a fatality. The time period is slightly different. What we did here, we started in October of 2014. The reason we did that is because prior to that time, we had seen reductions, historically low numbers and rates of fatalities. In October of 2014 is the first month where we started to see increases. And we made it through August of 2015, and I'll talk about, you know, some of the reasons behind some of the crashes, causative data. That was the end where we thought we could have fairly solid data, although still preliminary, but not real loose on that. But so each of these yellow points indicates a fatality spread across the state. This, of those yellow points where we have a fatality, these are each of the pedestrian fatalities. And again, even in this time period, up starkly over a previous year. That's what that looks like. And these are motorcycle fatalities. One thing that we can say, and I'll get into causation in a bit, but one thing we think we know about motorcycle fatalities this year is that January through March was the warmest on record. So we expect that motorcyclists were out earlier. They had more months of travel on their bikes. In that first 3 months, we had 10 motorcycle fatalities, where in a normal year we would have three or four. So we believe that explains some of that increase.
Mr. Chair. Oops. Mr. Vice Chair.
Yes, go ahead. With a question.
Oregon, with a question. Oregon still has a motorcycle helmet law. Some other states have repealed their motorcycle helmet laws. What have you seen in terms of percentage of increase or decrease motorcycle fatalities in Oregon versus those states that have repealed their motorcycle helmet laws?
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, and Senator Monroe, I'm unfortunately going to have to get back to you with data on the motorcycle helmet law changes from when Oregon instituted the helmet law, and then changes that other states have seen when they went back. I will tell you, I was just visiting family back in Minnesota about a month ago, and it was jarring to me to see most motorcycles not wearing a helmet. It's insane to me, but there you go. But I can get that data for you. I'd be happy to do so.
I really need it. I was very involved in Oregon passing motorcycle helmet law requiring and in maintaining it. And so we always have a few legislators that would like to repeal the motorcycle helmet law, like has happened in some other states. I want to have necessary data to battle them.
I'll provide that to you, Senator.
Senator Girard?
I would appreciate it if you didn't give him the data, but okay. The question I have is just an observation. Along the coast, I would expect to see some fatalities, and I don't see any. Is that kind of a, is this just an abnormal year, or is it kind of, because motorcycles kind of go crazy around some of those curves, and I just, it's just an observation.
Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, that is an interesting observation, and I'll try to go back and take a look at that. My recollection, I will tell you, my recollection is within the last month since that data came through, there was at least one additional fatality on 101.
Right. North of Florence, yeah.
Right.
101 is kind of a mess, to be honest.
Well, my observation was that it looks like most of them are, a good proportion of them are on rural roads, mm-hmm. or rural areas at least. People doing crazy things.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, as I had mentioned, for the 5 years preceding this time period of October 14 to August of 15, we really had seen historic lows. The raw number of fatalities on Oregon roads, we had not seen that low a number since the 1940s. The rate, which we calculate as number of fatalities per 100 million VMT, vehicle miles traveled, in that previous 5 years was the lowest on record in all time for Oregon. So we were definitely headed in the right direction and in historic lows. Unfortunately, in this time period, that October 14 to August of 15, we see this. That red line, unfortunately, is that 11-month period where the fatalities have gone up, and you can see it month by month. The blue line below is that average over the five previous years. So we see a pretty significant increase. In August, you can see it trending down, and we would hope that would continue to be a trend and not just a blip. So the earlier discussion about VMT increases, it's sort of axiomatic that as VMT goes up, the number of crashes, the number of fatalities also goes up. So one might think that that explains this. And unfortunately, the answer is it does not. It probably explains it to some degree. But even normalized for VMT, you'll see that red line is still where we are in fatalities for this time period we're talking about, whereas that blue line, again, that historic low.
Wouldn't you think that it actually would go up exponentially? Because as you get not just more traffic, but more congestion.
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer, I mean, as we look, as we get more time to look at the data and look at it more thoroughly, you know, congestion may become a factor that we find to be there, that there's a there, so to say. But we'll see by looking back historically, what we really have seen is that the numbers go down. So we see in 2015, and we've only got VMT data through July. We didn't want to project it out. But so using those numbers and the fatalities to that date, we really took a significant jump over 2014. For context, I do want to point out that going back to 2008, the rate we have showing so far for 2015 is below where we were at in 2008 and the years prior to that. So we're better than there, but we're still, you know, that's 6-7 years ago. We should be doing better. This is unacceptable. We're headed in the wrong direction. But, yeah, I think you're right, Chair Beyer. We should be looking at congestion and see how that impacts in terms of location.
Chair Beyer, in general, congestion would actually increase the number of crashes, but actually helps reduce the severity of those crashes from a fatality. So the numbers you're seeing from Amy here are fatal accidents. Generally, in a congested situation, we have more crashes, but they're less serious.
Yeah.
That's right.
So when we move into the question of causation, this is that map again, and where we saw in the first map, all of the pins were yellow for fatality. This is just where those fatalities were speed-related, so you can see a significant amount there. That's 133 fatalities, or 36% of all fatalities involved speed, whether speeding technically over the speed limit or too fast for conditions. This is alcohol-related. Now, this is a number that probably we'll see go up a little bit when I say this is preliminary data as toxicology things come in. Maybe go up a little. But again, 93 crashes, 101 fatalities, or 101 fatalities are alcohol-related. A point here that some folks don't think of, but that I think we need to talk about, is the idea of alcohol involved with pedestrian fatals. And by that, I mean pedestrians who are under the influence. 22% of our pedestrian fatalities have the pedestrian at a 0.08 BAC or higher, up to a 0.4 BAC, 0.4 BAC. That is a factor. Not in all cases, but it's something that is real.
Pretty hard to walk at 0.4.
You'd have to be a trained professional, I would say. This next one is lane and road departure, so people crossing over into the wrong lane, heading off the highway. And you can see that thing is just sort of dripping in blue. That is a total of 220 crashes, 60% of all fatal crashes, road and lane departure. It's huge.
Wow.
I don't have a slide for this, but I want to talk about safety belts.
Can I go with the next question?
Go ahead.
Does fog play a role in that? You know, I mean, Oregon's known for a lot of fog, and it seems like, don't worry about it.
weather in general, Senator Girard, does obviously play a factor, both, as Amy was talking about, from a motorcycle standpoint, both positive and negatively. So this last winter, we saw a mild winter. We saw an increase in crashes because of maybe speed or motorcycles that were out there, but we saw a reduction in crashes that were maybe weather-related during that same time period.
But it's just fog. If it's real foggy, you know, seeing the sign and maybe not, you know, going past a do not enter or something like that, I mean, I've seen fog up around Woodburn, and I couldn't find my way out of there, and I've lived here my whole life, you know.
Captain Anderson, maybe you're talking about this too, but one of the biggest single factors that we see in these is distracted drivers that are using their cell phones, smartphones, doing something else in their vehicle is what's one of the largest causes that we see in the roadway departures.
I was going to ask you about that. I was waiting to see if that was a slide.
I do have something to talk about with that in a minute. I can flip to it here. Another thing I don't have a slide on is road departure. I'll come back to belts later, distraction. So the numbers are quite underwhelming. 17 fatalities, 5% of all fatalities. And the question is that because it truly is not distraction that's causing the fatalities, or is it woefully underreported? And I would say that is the case. Unless you've got a person self-reporting that they were distracted, or you get a warrant to check the person's cell phone to see if they were on it, or a warrant to check the so-called black box of the car to see what was going on there. A lot of these things are unknown, and I would suggest unknowable. But when we, I'll flip ahead a couple of charts. Oops. Let's look at this one. This is overlaying that blue road departure over the all fatals, and you can see what a significant amount that that is. But if we take all those road and lane departure fatalities and we strip out those involving speed, those involving alcohol, and even those where we already have an indication that there was a drowsiness or fatigue issue, strip all those out, we've still got 50 or 60 fatalities that are road and lane departure. And I would suggest that a reasonable person would infer that that is distraction. So I think it's terribly underreported. It is on some level unknowable, but it's a real problem.
Yep.
Just briefly again, talking about safety belts. Oregon does a tremendous job. 98-99% of Oregonians wear their safety belt, so we're usually number one or two in the country in terms of that. Not wearing your belt is definitely hazardous to your health. In this time period, we've got 83 occupant vehicle fatalities, so those who can wear a belt or in a car, 83 fatalities. So when you've got 98 or 99% of people wearing a belt, that's quite a skew, showing that belts save lives. So I think that's important.
Chair.
Senator.
Let me see if I understand. Do you know what percentage of fatalities were not wearing their seat belts?
That's over 30%.
Over 30%.
That's right.
And yet, of all drivers, only 2% are not wearing their seat belts.
That's right.
But of those 2%, they lead to 30% of the fatalities.
That's right. Belt save lives.
I had something to do with the seatbelt law being passed here in the state of Oregon, too, so I'm very interested in those statistics.
Very good.
Yeah, something to do with a lot of this stuff.
So what are we doing about this? What are we doing about fatalities? So from the Transportation Safety Division, what I can talk about is the use of federal funds, some of which is very, targeted by federal prescription. but we try to use the data as quickly as we can to look at what's happening and target specific solutions in specific geographic areas, pardon me, to get at these issues. So we do things like overtime, paying for overtime for specific types of law enforcement actions, Dewey saturation, speed saturation, pedestrian enforcement activities, $3.7 million a year for that kind of activity. Media campaigns for education. Here's examples of some of the education we do, specific federal money to get people to think about, slowing down, getting off their cell phone, seeing pedestrians, that sort of thing. $1.3 million for education awareness and also surveys to figure out what people are hearing, what are the messages they're hearing, and what do they need to hear. Roadway safety, infrastructure, and training, $7.4 million. Teen driver education, so we can teach our brand new drivers in a course that is among the leaders in this nation. It is a tuition supplement, $2.6 million a year. And then we also do, in terms of strategic planning, every year the Oregon Traffic Safety Performance Plan, ODOT, local government, law enforcement, other safety stakeholders and experts get together, look at the data, look at what strategies need to be implemented and where we're going to direct those millions of federal dollars to try to have an impact that year. And then every 5 years, the Transportation Safety Action Plan. We're in the middle of updating that. It's due out October of 2016, where we take a five-year, longer range, sort of visionary look at what we need to be doing as a state to improve outcomes in transportation safety.
Amy, back to your media campaign. Just the statistics you were citing on percentage of drivers that use their seat belt, I think you're... Click it or ticket media campaign has been a very good awareness thing. Mm-hmm. I sort of wonder if it wouldn't be worthwhile to revisit maybe increasing, if we can, or targeting the similar campaign for the texting while driving. Just amazed, particularly at young people, the number of people are out there that are doing that.
Right. Right, that top middle item there is talking about cell phone and texting use. But right, anything we can do to get people to stop doing that extremely dangerous behavior.
Is it $500? What did we pass for texting while driving? What's the fine?
I don't recall.
It's $110.
It's a Class D. Right?
I thought it went up. I thought Courtney's bill.
That it bumped.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Gerard, it's $110 is the presumptive fine.
That's a pretty good fine.
But it's hard to, it's hard to detect.
It is, and I'll talk about a little bit about that in my testimony.
Mm, that should be more than
that. Well, I suspect, although it may not be any better, but we're probably moving away from people talking handheld cell phones just because the cars are all adapting to it. But I don't know if the distractions go down with that or not.
Yeah.
Paul? Will you?
Thank you. So again, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT, going to talk a little bit about our safety program. Before I get too much into that, I just want to remind you, you'd be hard-pressed to find projects that we do from an engineering standpoint that don't have a safety aspect to them. Many of the projects, if not all the projects I briefed you on earlier, all have key safety projects and benefits to them. What I'm going to talk about today are the dollars that we set aside specifically for targeted safety improvements that we have both proactively and reactively on our system. So as I give you an overview, we're in the midst of a transition in our safety program with the passage of MAP 21 at the federal level gave us new direction on how to approach our safety program. And it really is a shift from one that focuses on key kind of hot spots and where we see a number of crashes to one that is very data-driven, that's jurisdictionally blind and focused on not only on these hot spots but some of the proactive systemic improvements that we know have high effectiveness in their safety countermeasures. So first of all, just from a data-driven, it's a key point in the new direction that we're going, focused not just on all crashes, but on those serious crashes that Amy was talking about, the fatal accidents and the ones with serious injuries, and not so much on the ones where you have a whole series of maybe fender benders at a particular intersection, but really focusing on those real serious crashes that we have. We're also shifting to a jurisdictionally blind. We know about half of the crashes on our systems, you saw the map, about half of those crashes happen off the state highway system, half of them are on the state highway system. And so if we're going to make real headway in reducing those fatal and serious accidents, we need to focus throughout our system. And so we've been working with local governments and coming up with areas where they can use the federal dollars on their system as well. And then probably the most key, or one of the other key shifts, is really from this away from hotspots to moving, continue to work on hotspots, but also the systemic improvements that we know from a proactive standpoint have high benefits. So here's just a little kind of flow chart or a little different look at when we talk about the ARTS program or the All Road Safety Program. Of how we divide those funds up. So about half of it goes towards systemic improvements, half goes towards more traditional hotspots that we see out there where there are high crash locations. So I'll talk a little bit under the systemic ones and some of those, the data that Amy was sharing. It's really that data-driven process. Those roadway departures we were just talking about, half our funds on the systemic side goes towards countermeasures for roadway departure, intersections, bike ped, to target those areas where we see high incidences of crash. So talking specifically about some of those countermeasures, cable barriers, we had quite a bit of discussion last session about cable barriers and gave the department clear direction to close up the median on the interstate system. We're well on our way of doing that. Also in the session at the very end, there was funds included for specific cable barriers in Southern Oregon. That project itself will complete I-5 and closing the median in Oregon. There was also another project to make safety improvements between Pendleton and the Grand, which will also help us close the median on I-84 between Pendleton and the Grand in that area. But we continue to look where we have opportunities to use our safety funds to meet that 2021 target of closing all the medians in Oregon on the interstate system, a very cost-effective tool that we have. Another one is rumble strips. You see more and more our use of rumble strips in the shoulders and also on centerline rumble strips. Both those have, again, a high rate of return in reducing crashes. We estimate somewhere between 20 and 30% crashes can be reduced by the simple placing of rumble strips. Some of the challenges we have with rumble strips, certainly on the shoulders with bicyclists that use the shoulders, can be a challenge. And so working with the bicycle community to place those in the right place. You see in the photograph here, placing them on the fog line seems to be kind of a good compromise between both of those two. The other challenge we have is with noise. If you're in your car and you go across a rumble strip, they're pretty loud. If your house happens to be right next to where that rumble strip is, I can tell you it's even louder than that. And so trying to place these in areas that don't have that negative impact on those communities, but still provide the safety benefit that we know they can provide. The other focus on the roadway departure is on curb warning signs, some very simple upgrades of putting chevron signs, flashing beacons, other just larger signs, speed rider signs, some pretty basic things we can do. We're seeing 20 or 30% reduction in crashes in those curves just by putting up better signing. So those are some of the kind of proactive countermeasures that we're doing for those roadway departures. For intersection and bike ped, rumble strips, approaching stop signs, tools that have been used, you know, for a long time on roadways we continue to use in strategic places. Reflective signal heads, this is where we're replacing the background areas. It's hard to see in that photograph, but you look maybe in the left signal head, there's that bright yellow reflective area we put behind the signal head to draw attention to those. I know, Senator Beyer, there's a very tragic fatality in your area in 126 where we've gone back now since that crash and replaced those in that area. It's a very effective tool just to draw attention to traffic signals and reduce the people running the signals. The last is the rapid flashing beacon and the crosswalks. You see more and more of those around. Those are very effective in helping pedestrians, help motivate people and feel safer out there when they're walking, but also provide a safer way for pedestrians across the highway.
Let me interrupt and ask you a question. What is the difference? I know in my community where I live, there's some that are flashing red lights and flashing, and you can go through, and other ones that are just the flashing yellow. And then the flashing yellow, the early ones are not as bright as the new ones that have kind of a horizontal LED bar. You can't miss those. But
right. Senator Beyer, those are the standard ones that we're putting in now. Obviously, the yellow is a caution and warning for drivers to yield to pedestrians in that marked crosswalk. The red ones would be actually a traffic signal where you're required to stop at that red signal. Those are not the ones that, you know, we're really targeting in this area. The rapid flashing beacons are the latter ones that you described with those horizontal bars and those real bright amber lights that are very effective, especially in urban areas.
Senator Gerard and Senator.
Thank you. The question I had actually was with the slide before, and I live out in the boonies, and so we have a lot of passing lanes with a single lane on one side and two lanes on the other, and they're going around curves. And I noticed that when you put up the fatalities, I noticed areas that was a factor. What can you do in those areas? The solution that you're using on I-5 I don't think would work, but it seems to me like those areas, it's kind of worrisome. I mean, if I'm doing an outside pass and it's an inside curve, it's kind of scary that way, because it doesn't take much to wander over the.
Yes, Senator Jordan, what we're finding is that both the centerline rumble strips and the shoulder rumble strips are effective on those two-lane roadways. Obviously, putting up, you know, cable barrier or some kind of barrier on two-lane roadways is not feasible.
Yeah.
But we're finding the rumble strips, both on the center line as well as in the shoulders, again, in the right applications, can be very effective.
Senator
Riley. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that everything we're talking about is about people who are driving. And I know a lot of countries have very strict ways to keep people from starting to drive, harder driver's tests. Testing ability more than what we test is knowledge more than ability in our testing. And a lot of countries test ability before you can get a license. Is there any thought about that? Should we be thinking about that?
If I may, Chair Beyer and Senator Riley, particularly in the in teens who are, you know, the primary folks who are becoming drivers, Oregon has an excellent teen driver education program. That's something like 30-plus hours in the classroom, plus many hours behind the wheel with a trained professional, plus 50 hours riding with mom and dad or some other responsible adult. However, that program's not mandatory. It is encouraged in many ways. There are tuition supplements I talked about earlier. We have moved to, just as of January, I believe, where DMV now accepts the completion of that course, passage of that course, then the behind-the-wheel test is waived. Because the reality is the behind-the-wheel test given at the end of that course to pass the class is better than the 15-minute test you get at the DMV. So a number of ways that we are encouraging that class, and the numbers bear out that kids who take that class successfully have far fewer crashes, right, tickets, suspensions, but it's not mandatory.
I hear what you just said. Thank you.
I hear a bill proposal.
So the last point I want to make, I want to talk about kind of our emergency response, and in particular, secondary crashes. So earlier today or this afternoon, we were talking about congestion, and one of the major causes of that was pointed out in the presentation are crashes that cause that congestion. Also, crashes in congested areas cause additional crashes, and so the faster we can get out there, get the roadway open, not only is better for congestion, but also better for safety in reducing further crashes that happen as a result of maybe the first crash. So some of the things we're doing to improve that and address those secondary crashes. One of the first things you heard about that in Ryan's testimony earlier, the variable speeds. We're seeing about a 12% reduction in crashes on 217 so far, just because drivers have a little better indication with those variable speeds that some slower traffic is coming up ahead of them, and they have a chance to adjust their driving. It's because of that we're seeing a reduction in crashes. Another use of technology we're using is in Deschutes County. Where we've gone to sharing data between the responding agencies. So the data that ODOT uses, the data that OSP uses, the sheriff office, the local fire department, there's I believe it's called the data bus, but we're all having the same common data that we're entering into and talking from, and rather than having our own data then picking up the phone and calling OSP, we have a common data piece that we're all entering into and out of, and that has proven to be very efficient and very effective in a time-critical situation of getting the right information to the right people to address the incident. We're seeing the duration of our incidences in Deschutes County go down by 38% as we implement this. We're going beyond just Deschutes County and heading throughout the 97 corridor and eventually into the Portland area. But it's proven to be a very effective tool of technology of just us emergency responders coordinating our efforts in a much more efficient manner. You probably see our incident response trucks driving up and down the freeway in the Portland area, very effective, very popular with the public as we respond to incidences. We're expanding that into the Rogue Valley and seeing similar benefits of that incident response vehicle in the Rogue Valley. We're also out training our partners. We've trained 2,700 first responders, local law enforcement, fire. As you see in the photograph that I've put up here, it's on the interstate bridge. There's state police that are out there, law enforcement. There's our staff. There's fire out there. So what's our role? When we all roll up on scene, what are we doing? What's our role with a common purpose of accomplishing our individual missions as well as getting that roadway open and get the incident back open again to reduce congestion and reduce those secondary crashes? All this is helping out. During the last 3 years, we've seen crashes go up. So this is all crashes go up by about 9%. We're seeing the duration of those incidences go down by about 16% because of our efforts. So they're paying off in reducing those secondary crashes and reducing congestion. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Captain Anderson to talk about the enforcement aspect.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Anderson. I'm a captain with the Oregon State Police, and I currently serve as director of the patrol division. I first want to say thank you for this opportunity to discuss traffic safety, and in particular the rising fatal crash rates here in Oregon. Monitoring and improving traffic safety is, you know, one of the most critical components of achieving our mission, and it's something that we should and do take very seriously. Now, our primary role in reducing fatal crashes is to identify those driving behaviors that lead to such events, and then utilize enforcement and education to try and make a positive difference. Today, what I'm going to talk about are some of the things, proactive steps that we're taking to try and make a difference that we've implemented now and are planning on implementing in the short term, in the near future. The first one of those would be a key performance measure that we proposed, and it was adopted in this last legislative session, that calls for a 25% reduction in fatal crashes over a 10-year period in our area of responsibility. The baseline or starting point was based on a 5-year average between the years 2008 and 2012, and that came out to 134 fatal crashes. So by 2022, our goal is to be at 101 fatal crashes or fewer. We'll definitely take fewer. Of course, the ultimate goal is zero, but we do feel that this KPM represents a good start, a good foundation from which to move forward. So I guess the next question is, how are we going to try and achieve this KPM? Well, I mentioned earlier that one of our primary goals or in effecting change is to identify those driving behaviors that lead to fatal crashes. Well, we've done that. The causes of fatal crashes really haven't changed over time. But what we did is we looked at what are the most common driving behaviors, and we termed those the Fatal Five. And they're represented by the acronym SOLID. So speed, occupant safety, lane safety, impaired driving, and distracted driving. So we have identified the group of traffic violations or traffic crimes that fit into each one of those categories. And then we emphasize to our troops to look for those types of behaviors and focus on those. So we wanted to go a step further, and we felt to really be successful, we needed to get that data into the hands of our area commanders so they could analyze it and then deploy our resources in the best way that we could or they could. So thankfully, because of our use now of electronic citations and warnings and our new records management system, a few months ago, I was able to start sending monthly reports to our area commanders that shows Fatal Five enforcement data by office. And they then can compare that month to month. How many impaired drivers is our office arresting? How many distracted driving citations and warnings are we issuing? Can we do better? Where can we do better? Where do we need to emphasize more enforcement? And they can actually go a little further than that. They can go into the system and see by hour and by day, when are we getting most of our driving complaints in that on which roadways? When are we arresting most of our impaired drivers? When are we citing more people or getting driving complaints on distracted driving? So it's really an example of being able to use this new technology and new records management system to hopefully improve what we do. The next step that we're taking, actually it's perfect timing with this hearing, because in the next couple weeks we're going to begin deploying 40 unmarked patrol cars around the state. These cars will go to offices that have high fatal crash rates, high levels of Fatal Five enforcement, and they will be assigned to troopers that have shown a high level of activity specifically related to Fatal Five categories. So why unmarked cars? Well, this kind of hits on the distracted driving issue that came up earlier. Our marked cars are great. They represent who we are, and they act as a great deterrence. But we receive over 42,000 driving complaints in a year, pretty much. And many times by the time our trooper gets there, now we can only write a citation or take enforcement action if we observe the violation. So many times by the time we get there, that marked unit is great, but many times the violator sees the marked unit, stops texting, stops talking on the phone, slows down, which is great. We've changed behavior. But what we want to do is use those unmarked cars to go that step further, see the violation, solidify the violation, make the stop, and then use enforcement and education to hopefully make a bigger impact towards traffic safety. The next step we actually implemented a few months ago is a new disposition code. Now, in our areas of responsibility, the majority of our fatal crashes we cover are on rural highways, not on the interstate system. But the majority of our driving complaints are on the interstate system. So because of our limited resources, we may have one trooper assigned to a rural highway system to patrol. But the number of driving complaints that are coming in are pulling that trooper back to the interstate. So the driving behaviors out on the rural area aren't being impacted so much because that trooper is no longer there. So this new disposition code, and I guess I should back up a little bit, each of our calls for service are cleared with a disposition code. So I go out on a stop, I clear a code 5 means I'm going to write a report. A code 22 means I help the disabled motorist. So this new code is code 19, and what it's going to do is allow the trooper to analyze that call for service and determine, should I respond given the level of safety required, or does it justify my response from a rural patrol area, say, to the interstate when the level of safety is not high and my travel time and my response time is prohibitive? And then the trooper that can just clear the call with a code 19, meaning I've analyzed the call, I feel it's more important for me to stay here in this rural area where we have a history of fatal crashes, and have a positive impact on the driving behavior here. Yeah. And then lastly, what I'd like to talk about is an easier way for the public to get a hold of us. We are very, very dependent on the public to help us do our job. They see a lot more than we do, driving behaviors. But many times the public has a difficult time remembering how to get a hold of the police. They don't know the number other than 911. And so they call 911, and it's an improper use of the system. So what we have developed, and we're hoping to roll it out by the first of the year, is STAR OSP. And what this will do is it'll be a direct line communication to our dispatch center. So the public that is using our roadways, if they see a violation, they see a public safety issue, they simply dial STAR OSP, and it goes right to our dispatch center, who can then locate the nearest trooper and respond to the call. We really feel this will be a benefit to us and the public. Now, as it becomes closer, we will start an advertising campaign. We've already reached out to ODOT to start thinking about putting some signs in critical strategic areas of the roadways, advertising this STAR OSP. So those are some of the things that we're doing moving forward and hoping to meet that KPM, that goal, that KPM. Of course, the legislature did give us 20 new troopers that are being phased in this biennium. That's going to be a huge help. We will obviously allocate those to areas of greatest need when the time comes. But I guess in closing, I just want to reiterate our commitment to traffic safety and prevention of fatal crashes, and we are very optimistic about these measures we're taking now and going forward. So that concludes my testimony.
Captain, I appreciate that. I thought for a long time about the signs in terms of, you see somebody doing something crazy. I was driving home last night, and there was a trucker that was all over the road, and it was kind of like, well, how do you call? They call 911, and then where am I? You know, what's my outpost?
Be sure you stop before you do STAR OSP.
Well, wasn't any place to call. Mine's all voice activated. Senator Riley, Jim?
Yeah, I was wondering, Captain, what's your coverage now? I mean, you have a certain number of officers, and at one point we didn't have 24-hour coverage on many roads, and we still don't, I'm sure. Where are we on that, in that situation?
Sure. Chair Byers, Senator Riley. Yes, we currently do not have 24/7 coverage. I was recently informed that our Bend office has scraped together a very skeleton 24-hour coverage. But our trooper strength, before the 20 troopers, sat at about 334 sworn troopers. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include sergeants and above. So the 20 will add, you know, up to 354, assuming some of those, all of those come to patrol division. But currently we're carrying just over 30 vacancies. That's the most difficult part, is to keep up with our attrition. For several years now, we lose approximately 2.5 sworn members per month to whatever reason, retirement or leaving the agency. So it's keeping up with that attrition that is the most difficult part, and it takes a considerable amount of time to train a new police officer.
Thank you.
Mark?
Yep.
Senator?
Well, my experience in 50 years of thinking and working on these issues is that OSP is one of the finest groups of law enforcement people anywhere in the world, and I'm very proud of the work that you do. I also know that there are far less troopers than there were in 1980 when you got pulled out of the highway fund by legislative action. I think about how much safer our roads and highways would be if we could give you not 20 more, but about 150 more.
Chair Byers, Senator Monroe, thank you very much for those comments. They mean quite a bit. Thank you.
Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Very informative.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Appreciate your efforts.
Patrick, I think we're at the end of the agenda, unless you hit another page on me.
No, sir. Our next meeting, Mr. Chair, will be Tuesday, November 17th, same time in the afternoon. So you can mark your calendars for that.
Anything else for the good of the order, members? Adjourn. Adjourn.